on the northern panel's docket today is Mandalay Corporation versus the Judicial District, 61189. Mr. Kravitz, ready to proceed?
I am, Your Honor. Thank you.
All right.
Please, the court, counsel. Your Honor, this case involves an issue of first impression, as does the one that is following. The issue is, what is the impact of the comparative contribution statute in your decision in Cafe Moto, as opposed to its practical implications under Rule 19, and whether the intentional tortfeasor, in this case a rapist, needs to be at the table as a party during the course of the trial. If we look at your Cafe Moto decision, it's an argument that I've been trying to make to district judges for about 15 years, and have always been rejected. They've always held that unless the plaintiff was comparatively negligent, that I was not allowed to get several liability for the hotel for its allegedly negligent conduct, but instead that the liability would be joint and several with the attacker, with the intentional tortfeasor. Cafe Moto finally did what I've been arguing for 15 years, which is, it's unfair to just pursue the deep pocket. It's unfair to make the hotel responsible jointly and severally when the real harm is inflicted by the attacker.
Could you be reading Cafe Moto a little too broadly?
Well, I don't think so. And quite frankly, in this particular case in Moran, which is the one that's before you now, this is a case that actually had some comparative negligence in it too, which would still result in a requirement for that jury to be some portion of the liability. So briefly, let me do the facts. Ms. Moran is an underage 18-year-old.
I mean, the facts, I think, we're all pretty well familiar with, and I guess the heart of what I want to get to is the most necessary and indispensable part of the issue, as well as whether he can plead for purposes of equitable indemnity, contribution, and apportionment. And so those are the two.
Well, that is the main issue.
Yes.
All right, so let's start with Rule 19. Rule 19 has two parts. The first is Rule 19A, and Rule 19A is the only rule that applies in this particular instance, because Rule 19A deals with the identification of the co-defendant. In both this case and the following case, the identification of the attacker, in this case the rapist, was well known. In this case, the plaintiff actually sued him, and throughout the litigation, Mr. Ramirez was a party to this litigation. When Cafe Moto came down, what we did is we sent an offer of judgment with an explanation letter and talked about Cafe Moto. The next result was a calculated risk by Mr. Ware's law firm, and that was we're going to dismiss out the rapist. We don't want the rapist to be at the table. When I deposed Ms. Moran, her post-traumatic stress clearly comes from the vicious attack by this individual. She is suffering post-traumatic stress not because the hotel did anything or was in a position to do anything, but because the rapist attacked her. He's the one that she sees in her nightmares. He's the one that caused her to go get the treatment and needs to get over psychological stress. What Rule 19 says, and it's mandatory language, and I brought it because I can't memorize it, but I wanted to say what's in the rule. A person who is subject to service of process, Mr. Ramirez is sitting in prison right now in Indian Springs, whose joinder will not deprive the court of jurisdiction. He is there. Shall be joined. It's mandatory language. And if, in the absence of the person's absence, complete relief cannot be afforded, or the disposition of the action in the person's absence may, as a practical matter, impair or impede the ability to protect the interest, or leave the persons or parties already subject to the jurisdiction to a substantial risk of inconsistent verdicts. What happens in these cases is there is a substantial risk of an inconsistent verdict if what I'm left to is the idea that all you have to do is somewhere down the line go sue him on a contribution or a apportionment claim to try to get back the money, assuming he ever has any money. The result is you want to have one trial where the face of evil is sitting next to the allegedly negligent party. You want the jury to evaluate exactly who it is that caused her trauma. And this rule doesn't leave for much discretion. He was known. They knew where he was. He could be deposed by videotape. He could be a party to this lawsuit and then decided, Cafe Moto is dangerous. What it's going to do is let's make sure we only have Mandalay Bay sitting at this trial so that the focus of the jury's intent will only be on Mandalay Bay. Let's only focus on what they did or did not do. Let's not let the jury deal with the fact that Mr. Ramirez decided to go into this car and rape this woman. It leaves us with a bare remedy. It leaves us with no real practical way to deal with it. When it says inequity and good conscience under 19B, which is, by the way, the rule you use if you don't know the identity of the attacker, but think about equity and good conscience. Cafe Moda and the comparative contribution statute by themselves are actually equitable remedies. They are remedies to prevent the deep pocket from suffering the entire loss.
But you're arguing that they're a necessary party, correct?
Yes.
And if you can plead and you have that ability, doesn't that undermine your argument?
Well, the problem is that Judge Tao wrote a decision that said, number one, you're not entitled to equitable indemnity, you're not entitled to contribution, you're not entitled to apportionment, and then he refused to allow us to agree.
So assume for the moment that we disagree with those determinations to some degree.
I would want to bring him in, to have him sitting at that trial as a defendant, and I would probably have to videotape him, have him sit there and testify, and let the jury evaluate it. Then we would have to give some very
third-party defendant. Correct?
Yes, exactly.
Yes.
And then I would have to go ahead and ask the jury with very special interrogatories and questions to evaluate the several liability of the parties. His joint and several liability are several liability. What left me bewildered by Judge Tao's decision was this idea that he didn't even think that the intentional tracer was even necessary when he's the one that promulgated the act.
If you look at the sure Cafe Moda went that far either.
Yeah, but Reed versus Royal Blood did a long time ago. And it says that if your liability is dependent upon the actions of a third party, then you have a right to have that party at the trial. That's equitable indemnity. Then the Cafe Moda and the comparative contribution.
What's your special relationship here for equitable indemnity purposes?
Well, I'm trying to remember the reading of the rule. I don't remember Reed saying that you had to have a special relationship if the equitable, not the specific express indemnity.
That was for equitable indemnity.
But then what you wind up with is contribution, which is the alternative. So it would be contribution, which I would still be entitled to receive. And then more importantly, what's most important to me is the apportionment argument. Because the comparative contribution statute says specifically that, or the concept is, that there will be a percentage of fault applied to us. And if that verdict was, let's say, $1 million, and it comes back as 10% responsibility, you're going to pay $100,000. That's a significant benefit and a significant savings. That's what the legislature wanted. The crimes occur in hotels just about every day of the week. It's unfortunate that what happens in these crimes is that the hotel, because of its deep pocket, becomes the target. And as a result of that, if the plaintiff makes a litigation decision not to have him there, the defendant should have an absolute right to have him there. And that is the problem with what we've got with Judge Tao's decision. He said I wasn't entitled to anything. We made a timely motion after the dismissal, and he said, no, I'm not going to let you have it. There will be no equitable indemnity, there will be no contribution, there will be no apportionment. So effectively, he wanted me to try this case without the rapist involved. That's not fair. That's not what the legislature intended. And so that is why we were asking for the writ, to at the very least compel the addition or allow us to file that third-party complaint to bring him back in. And I want to be able to argue it to that jury at the end. Notice that the plaintiff didn't sue him.
What was his basis for denying you leave to amend and to file?
He said it would be futile.
Because he's a prisoner?
Because as a prisoner, he might not have any assets. I would submit to you that's not the test. Does he have liability is the test. And more importantly,
apportionment.
Yeah, apportionment. Suppose somebody down the line, he hits the lottery. I don't know. He inherits money. Maybe he does have money buried in a bag somewhere. But the reality is that's not what you look at. You look at whether there's potential apportionment or liability. And it's clear cut in this case. There's absolute apportionment. Requirement that the comparative contribution statute requires.
Did he cite any cases in his decision to deny you leave to amend?
No. He just wrote some language. He did sort of his own investigation. I actually was bewildered. We didn't get to argue this one. There was no oral argument on it, so there were no questions asked. Instead, there was a written decision where he sat down and sort of, you know, espoused what he viewed the cafe modem that, and then said in the end that it would be futile to sue him because he probably doesn't have any assets.
Well, Mr. Kravitz, that's not exactly a correct representation of Judge Tao's order on page 11, lines 7 through 14. While it is true that he says that it's futile because of Ramirez's indigent status, he does cite to Black and Decker and says that the legal relationship between Ramirez and the defendant cannot be demonstrated, which is a necessary requirement.
That is for equitable indemnity, Your Honor.
I got that, but it's in the same paragraph that deals with...
You have to separate the two concepts. I mean, obviously, how does that justify no contribution? How does that justify no apportionment? Both of those are equitable remedies that are not barred by special relationship. And so he didn't address... If you take that paragraph...
Your criticism of his order is the absence of citation for contribution and apportionment against equitable indemnity.
Yes, sir.
All right.
May I reserve the rest of my time?
Of course.
Thank you.
Mr. Rowe?
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel, David Wall, on behalf of the real party in interest here, Julia Moran. The effective result of what Mandalay is asking you to do is to create a judicially created mandate in a negligent security case that a plaintiff must sue another defendant for another cause of action in order to shield them from liability, and they do this by trying to stretch Cafe Moda until it's unrecognizable. Look, Cafe Moda, the issue there, as framed by Justice Perrigary writing for the court, was as follows. In this appeal, we consider whether NRS 41141, Nevada's comparative negligence statute, permits liability to be apportioned between a negligent tortfeasor and an intentional tortfeasor. And the court found that it is permitted under the balance in 41141. And Cafe Moda basically says, if you're going to sue them both, how does the trial court address 41141 when it comes to the apportionment that's necessary under that particular statute? And it only happens when comparative negligence is alleged in good faith. And here's how you use 41141. That's what Cafe Moda sets out. That's a choice made by a plaintiff when they seek to sue both the negligent and the intentional tortfeasor. Cafe Moda does not say, in a negligent security case, a plaintiff must also sue the intentional tortfeasor. It doesn't say that hundreds of years of common law where the plaintiff has a decision of who to sue is now abrogated. It doesn't say that a cause of action for negligent security mandates that the intentional tortfeasor be pursued and named so as to limit the liability of the premises owner. It does not say that the criminal or the intentional tortfeasor is a necessary party under Rule 19.
Best for me, Judge Tao's ruling as it pertains to contribution and apportionment as opposed to equitable indemnity.
Here's what he did. Originally, when the motion was made, they sought to have a cross-claim against the criminal, the rapist, Mr. Ramirez. Mr. Ramirez was out of the case at that time, so Judge Tao, sort of sua sponte in his order, said, well, since he's out, you can't have a cross-claim, so let's review this under the standard of a third-party claim, as though you're seeking to have him as a third-party defendant. And what he did was he looked at the proposed complaint, or proposed third-party complaint. It was actually their answer on cross-claim. And he said it's not a valid third-party complaint anyway. For one thing, they're not liable for the same thing Mandalay is to the plaintiff. And under Rule 14, a third-party complaint is only designed, and we go back to Reed versus Royal Insurance, to suggest that that person is responsible for what Mandalay is ultimately responsible to Julia Moran. So we looked at apportionment, and there is no such cause of action as apportionment. If the idea is we want to put the rapist in the 41-141 balance, that's not a cause of action. And a third-party defendant doesn't end up in the apportionment calculation under 41-141. A third-party defendant for indemnity or contribution doesn't end up in the calculation under 41-141. Because contribution, for one thing, doesn't even ripen, the cause of action doesn't even ripen until after there's a finding or a judgment against the original defendant.
So he can still sue for contribution down after you prevail in the case.
If anyone really thought that what Mandalay Bay wanted out of this case and this appeal was the right to chase down Mr. Ramirez for whatever they owe Julia Moran for their breach in security, yes, they can. But that rapist is not included in the 41-141 apportionment balance as a third-party defendant for contribution. And Justice Hardesty is exactly correct that when Judge Tao looked at the equitable indemnity claim, he found there was no special relationship under 41-141. And what Mandalay argued to you in the briefs was, and what they argued to Judge Tao, essentially, is, hey, it's premature. We might have a special relationship with him. We just don't know. Discovery might show it. What in the world would that special relationship be? And I would even go so far as to say, you know, if they find during the course of discovery that they had a special relationship with the rapist, then maybe an equitable indemnity claim might lie as a third-party complaint.
Such as an employee.
Yeah, well, then they're on the hook vicariously under respondeat superior. So Judge Tao looked at each of the three potential causes of action they had and found that there's basically no substance to them and amendment would be futile. And that's really what they're talking about here. When you look at Rule 19 and necessary parties, we have to look to what the court has determined is a necessary party in other cases. And that is cases where someone who has an interest in the action under 19A, you sue the trustee, but really you have to have the beneficiaries in because they're affected by the outcome. Someone seeks to set aside a conveyance of property. Well, you have to have the actual bona fide purchaser in because they're a necessary party because they're affected by the outcome. The Blaine equipment case, which is actually cited by the respondents, where someone wins a competitive bidding process for a state contract, someone seeks to set that aside. Well, you've got to have the one who actually won it in as a necessary party. Extremely different from here. They're not alleging that Mr. Ramirez has a special relationship or a special interest in the outcome of this proceeding, and that's why they need them in. What they're arguing is they ought to be a third-party defendant. But Rule 14 practice is very different from Rule 19. Someone's not a necessary party just because a defendant wants to bring them in as a third-party defendant. That doesn't make them a necessary party under Rule 19. Let me add this.
Mr. Wall, before you proceed with your next thought, in the proposed answer and cross-claim, was there an assertion of contributory negligence? Mr. Kravitz was about to comment on that before the question from Justice Perry-Gary.
That was my next point.
Okay.
It is clear that none of this matters. I understand there's the overarching precedent in these cases. But in this case, it is entirely moot what they want to do. 41-141 is a comparative negligence statute. If there's, it goes back to Buck versus Greyhound, if there's no bona fide affirmative defense of comparative negligence, then none of this applies. There is no apportionment, 20% here, 80% there, under 41-141, if it's not a bona fide comparative negligence case.
Isn't that,
first of all,
fairly fact-driven?
Yeah, it is, in some respects. 2 points on this. Number one, I don't know that any court is prepared to say that a woman sleeping in her car is comparatively negligent for being raped. She's comparatively negligent for not locking the door in the car in their parking lot. Well, if that's negligence, then it must only be because it's foreseeable that there are criminals and rapists in the parking garage. Sort of cuts against their argument that there's no foreseeability to provide security. It's not negligence to sleep on a park bench at Mandalay. It's not negligence to fall asleep at the pool or on the comfortable sofa next to the concierge desk at Mandalay Bay.
But, Mr. Wall, could they get an instruction at trial on comparative negligence?
They could not, Justice Cherry, and here's why. Justice Hardesty is correct. Their original affirmative defense, answer in this case, they've included it in the record in pages 114 and 150. There is no affirmative defense pled for comparative negligence. There is no affirmative defense in their proposed new amended answer and cross-claim where they want to bring Mr. Ramirez into the calculation. Comparative negligence hasn't even been alleged in the case.
So why does California apply at all?
It doesn't. If there's no comparative negligence, there's no 41-141 downs, there's no CAFE MOTA analysis here that says rapist goes into the apportionment balance, because there is no apportionment balance. And if anything, he is simply a third-party defendant for contribution and indemnity, which, whether he wins a jackpot or not, great. Let them have at it. But it doesn't belong in the same trial with Julia Moran's allegation that their security was negligent. Thank you very much.
Any other questions for Mr. Wall? Okay, thank you, Mr. Wall. Mr. Crowley?
No, I'm really confused. If you look at Catherine Miller was a case where there was absolutely no finding by the jury of comparative negligence.
Let me just clear that up. Was there an affirmative defense of comparative negligence?
I don't know that the pleadings were. It doesn't mention that in the... Oh, in Catherine Miller?
No, in your case.
We've been arguing it since the beginning of the case. I mean, it's in the briefs, it's in the...
Was there an affirmative defense of
comparative negligence? If it isn't there, it will be if we need to. I don't remember the pleadings offhand. But the reality of this is I was always going to argue her, all the questions were asked of her regarding her comparative negligence. It's not because she didn't simply lock a door. It's because she goes out as an 18-year-old and drinks to excess, gets herself sick, doesn't go to security to ask for help, doesn't call her parents, lies to her parents about where she's at. She put a scenario in place to make herself a victim.
Procedurally, I'm still trying to get to that point.
But what difference does it make? I can still, without comparative negligence, I still, under CAFE MOTA, have a right to apportionment.
Where do you read that in CAFE MOTA?
Because that's the finding of the case.
I wrote it.
I know that. But do you remember what happened with the plaintiff? The plaintiff was found to be 0% comparatively negligent.
Correct.
Okay? Now, the case doesn't mention anything about there having been pled an affirmative defense of comparative negligence. It doesn't say that. So now we have a finding by a jury of no comparative negligence in the plaintiff, the liability on the part of the intentional tortfeasor, and apportionment on the part of granted after the fact by this court, by you.
Mr. Crowley, perhaps the jury in that case found no comparative negligence, but the law in the case is focused on the interpretation of the comparative negligence statute.
Agreed.
The apportionment ruling is a statutory apportionment.
Yes.
Your arguments today are predicated on equitable indemnity contribution.
And apportionment. You're asking for an apportionment of the land.
Well, okay, let's take up the apportionment.
Yes, sir.
Apportionment in Nevada occurs under 41-141, correct?
Yes, sir.
All right. That statute has not been implicated because my review of your pleadings indicate it has not been pled.
So you're telling me that I would have to simply plead that in order to activate it?
in good faith under Rule 11, indeed.
I mean, it's certainly proof under these facts, they're overwhelming, showing something
wrong. I'm not sure that appearing in front of the Supreme Court at this juncture is the right time to make that argument. One would think that it would have been made when the case was first pled.
We did leave, in all of our briefs, we laid out in front of the district court, both here and in the Humphreys case, the comparative negligence of the plaintiff. How the plaintiff was responsible. So it's not as though we haven't raised these facts throughout this case.
Okay.
So what is missing is the technicality of making the affirmative defense in the pleading. We've been denied the right to bring that third-party complaint.
Is a comparative negligence assertion waivable under Rule 8?
It is not whether the mandatory has to be done on the first get-go. It's not one of those that you have to plead instantaneously with the plaintiff. So there could be an amendment made for that if inequity and good conscience is supposed to be done. And if that's what the court's ruling is, we will certainly seek leave in that case, in this case, to do that.
Okay.
If all that's missing is that affirmative defense to trigger the apportionment, then it's necessary. Because this, I mean, one of the things that you did say, Judge Carragher, is you talked about the legislative intent to not just pursue the deep pocket. And that's what we're left with, which is we're the only ones at the table, and that really shouldn't be the case in a case like this. It's very unfair to hotels.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Carroll. So any questions from counsel? All right. We'll be in recess until 11:30.
All right.